Today is the day the Lord has made, and I am thankful and glad within it. And these are the times in which God has decided we will live. It's going to be sort of a different bit of a format these couple of days this week. I'm building up to this trial of Fauci that we've been talking about for some time. Tony Fauci has been the lead force behind what I consider to be the biggest human rights crime in history. And well, not in history, but in the history of my life. The lies about the COVID flu continue into this year. Washington State, Jay Inslee, has literally no plan to open the state of Washington. He has counties frozen at phase two. Meanwhile, Texas and Florida are open, and they've done better. And they're better than the states like California and New Jersey and New York. And they've done better, not just in rates of death. They've done better in not as many suicides. Or as we learned about this past Friday, in a piece in ProPublica. And now, when you hear this, I beg you to remember, there were those of us who have been talking about this for well over a year. And you're going to hear in just a few minutes an interview I did with a gentleman you will know as Ethical Skeptic. I know who he is. I know his background in naval intelligence. I know his background in big level, big league data analysis for countries and for companies. Okay. I know what he does and who he is. And I knew that when we interviewed him almost a year ago, or in fact, over a year ago. It's the only radio interview he's ever done. He's regarded by folks like Justin Hart and Ivor Cummings and Kyle Lamb and the independent data analysts who have helped crack open this swindle of the COVID flu. Ethical Skeptic is counted as perhaps the best of all the data analysts, all the independent data analysts. Now, I am going to tell you the headline from a piece in ProPublica. I said Friday. It was actually Thursday, May 4th, 5 a.m. Eastern date time. A crisis of undiagnosed cancers is emerging in the pandemic's second year. You're about to hear Ethical Skeptic predict, given the data signals he was seeing, a massive hit on the United States healthcare system from people who were scared to death to go to the hospital, even when they had signs of cancer. This is the way ProPublica, of course, puts it. A factory worker didn't want to call in sick or catch COVID-19, so she tried to ignore the pain. Now she has stage 4 cancer. And that's the case, of course, ProPublica is going to find. You can also find people who were not factory workers, who were retirees. They were young people. They were business owners. They were students. They were parents and grandparents who didn't go to the doctor because they were scared to death they would catch the COVID flu. Or because, as in states like Washington State, things that Jay Inslee decided were not serious enough to warrant a doctor visit were banned. Things like gallbladder surgery or having kidney stones removed. Kidney stones that in the process could turn out to have a cause. There could be a reason for the stones. We're going to see the results, not of a pandemic. And this is key and part and parcel of the lie of Tony Fauci and the World Health Organization. Friends, I can't say this any more clearly. This never would have counted as a pandemic had the World Health Organization not changed the definition of what counts as a pandemic. It would still be very serious for people who are three things: above 65 or 70, obese, and very low on vitamin D. Those are the common denominators for the COVID flu, with rare exceptions. But even now, we're starting to see other signals about this, which is why we're focusing on, in this first couple of days, we'll do the trial of Fauci on Wednesday. Now, clearly, I can't put him on trial. I'm not a department, I don't run the Department of Justice, nor am I a lawyer. But we will use Fauci's own words to compare what he has done. He has lied about the death rates. He has lied about masks. He lied about hydroxychloroquine. He is lying, saying that the mRNA injections in these other COVID so-called vaccines, and some of them do have some immunological abilities, but they're not stopping people from getting COVID. He's lied that those are the only ways. He has lied by inference about ivermectin. He's lied by not inference, by statement about hydroxychloroquine. He has lied. And what we're seeing is the results of these lies. And it is just frightening. Last week, we shared with you this piece that came from the New York Post. It's to my knowledge, it's the first so-called mainstream media organization to report on the fact that lockdown states did worse than non-lockdown states. The headline, states with strictest lockdowns ruin livelihoods without saving lives. Now, Fauci is at the top of this, along with the World Health Organization. And you can pretend all you like. If you enjoy pretending, you can pretend that this isn't tied to a great reset. You can pretend that we're not installing a universal basic income. We went out because it was Mother's Day weekend. We went out about three times this weekend. Once I took my mother out, another time I took my wife out, we went out with some friends. In each case, restaurants in Idaho and Spokane can't hire people. People don't want to work. Because they're getting checks, they're getting a universal basic income for businesses that never needed to be closed. If Home Depot didn't need to be closed, if McDonald's didn't need to be closed, Ma and Pa Deli didn't need to be closed, or the Indian restaurant, the 95 in Coeur d'Alene didn't need to be closed. It's getting worse than that. Doctors in Ontario, Canada are forbidden from contradicting the official COVID narrative under threat of discipline. This comes from the College of Physicians and Surgeons in Ontario. Doctors are not to speak out about being sane on woke masks. Hint, they don't work. They're not to be sane in terms of speaking out against lockdowns. Hint, they don't save lives. They are not to speak out against any of the injections for COVID-19 or even to critique them or to make perfectly sane suggestions, as you'll hear later this week from Dr. Andrew Bostom, who's an academic MD and epidemiologist. What Andy's going to tell you is you would be insane to shoot a kid up under the age of 17 with these injections because the risk-reward scenario is out of whack. It is not scientific. Best practices to tell scientists, and doctors are scientists, that they cannot share their opinion based upon the data. And yet in Ontario, that's what they're doing. Ontario is also the place where you have you have shutdowns of churches to the degree that they send 200 cops to surround the church, where they send cops to fence up and fence off restaurants. And this was shared with you this last week. You will want to get these assets, these articles. Text Todd, T-O-D-D, to 800-465-8770. You will want the show notes for this week. This last week from Alex Berenson and his analysis of the numbers. Outside of the United States and the UK, the West had no excess deaths under the age of 65 last year. None. In the West, the United States and the UK, a good portion of those deaths that were in excess were because of the lockdown. Because of things like banning procedures that so-called governors like Jay Inslee decided were not necessary, while allowing procedures he decided like abortions were necessary, or shooting wrong sex hormones into kids were necessary. So from Washington State and its ridiculous lockdown under the so-called governor into the other states that are in sort of partial sets of lockdowns, what Ethical Skeptic presented predicted and detailed is now happening. A wave of cancer deaths and other deaths that never needed to happen. When we check traffic, we'll come back from traffic. You will hear the interview we did, the only one he's ever done on the radio, with Ethical Skeptic. Let's check traffic now with Right Way Traffic. You know, I've been saying for some time that the story for me around reporting around the COVID has been the work of independent data analysts. And we've been so blessed to talk, for instance, with Dr. Andrew Bostom, who's been tracking the absolute fraud of the Atlantic COVID tracking project and their lies about the deaths in Florida. Legitimate lies at this point. They know they're doing that. We've talked with my friend Justin Hart, independent data analyst, Kyle Lamb, who calculated some of the deaths that are happening because of the lockdown. I am so excited to welcome who I think is the star of this particular field. Gentlemen, we're going to call Ethical Skeptic. He's Ethical Skeptic on Twitter. Ethical, welcome to the Todd Herman Show.
Hey, Todd. It's a pleasure to be on the Todd Herman Show.
Thank you so much. And I know this is, I believe this is your first radio interview as Ethical Skeptic. And you were kind enough to share with me who you are. So I can definitely see why you can do what you can do, which is phenomenal data analysts. So tell people a little bit about your background, then we'll get into your work and what you have been telling the people about the COVID.
Well, my background is systems engineering, and really in that regard, the top school in the world. Moved from that into naval intelligence, several theaters that I went through that don't want to talk about right now. But from naval intelligence, went in to start my own strategy and operations company and grew that to really be one of the top advisory companies in the world. Over 200 corporate clients and probably about 15 to 18 nations doing infrastructure and operations strategy, rollout planning, mergers, consolidations, development, all those critical aspects of what those entities do.
And so you're a systems thinker. You are very meticulous in how you view problems and unwind those, as what I see. And I started following you with your analysis of COVID. I want to ask real quick before we get into, for instance, this 6% number that the media doesn't understand why people like us are interested in that 6%. They think that we think it means that the virus doesn't exist or something. We'll talk about that. But what drew your attention to COVID-19 as someone who analyzes data and systems?
Well, initially, certainly the reports coming out of China were alarming, and justifiably so. The data continues, to look dire coming out of all the world statistics. So early on, it was a great concern for me because of my background and exposure in the medical and pharmaceutical industry, doing strategy in that industry over the decades. I was called in to do a minor part of the COVID response with a particular client. And from there, I was able to, gain proprietary data, in particular data, detailed data behind the scenes of COVID, and added hopefully a lot of value in the COVID response effort. But I was also able to use a lot of that data, the non-proprietary portion, to begin to develop and lens perspectives around the COVID issue. And my perspective on it did change a little bit across the months of analysis here. And you could see that, my timeline on Twitter or on the ethicalskeptic.com website, you can see the progression in my change of sentiment on the issue. Yeah.
Yeah, and so there's a lot of very interesting nuggets of information that you brought us. One of them is sort of an Uber analysis that I consider to be the most important chart I've ever seen. And this has to do in North America with the reality of the decrease in COVID deaths compared to this period of time where we heard from, I think, almost nearly unanimous in the media, we heard cases, cases, cases. And you display this so beautifully, and you've said some fairly serious things about this in regard to liability lawsuits, et cetera. So I wanted to start there, which is this comparison to the decrease in deaths that maps the way this virus works, the normal cycle, with this self-repeating, self-replicating sort of panic cycle that happens in the majority of the media. So can we talk through that?
Absolutely. I think this was one of the key elements that I analyzed that began to change my sentiment a little bit. And I want to make it clear, this is still a very dangerous virus. It's more severe than the flu. It's just asymmetric. In other words, its damage is done on a different end of the age tier spectrum than the flu. So for those under 60 years old, it's less dangerous than the flu. But for those over 80 years old, it's more dangerous than the flu. So that asymmetry, if you will, has caused us a lot of difficulty in discussing this issue in media sound bites. It's not that simple. But what I developed is a thing called the Lemming cycle of continuous impairment. And it's somewhat of a humorous title, not to make light of this issue itself. But it's both a parody and a satire. The parody is of a thing called the Deming cycle of continuous improvement, something that I'm familiar and worked with in my past. And it's developed by Dr. William Edwards Deming, and it's just a way of reducing costs and improving customer service and market delivery for a corporation or any operating entity. This is a parody of that, in that I call it the Lemming cycle of continuous impairment, but it's also the allegorical lemmings who run off a cliff as well. But it's also a satire of this condition wherein we use the rate of testing to falsely instill panic in our general population and our second-tier levels of government. In other words, early on, we didn't have enough test kits to determine what was the arrival rate of the pandemic. In other words, how fast was it growing? So we issued federal money, federal emergency money. We bought test kits and we deployed them to the field, all ethical things to do. And then when we saw the rate of cases that existed, we panicked. And we saw the curve of increase, that what everybody called exponential increase, we panicked. So we demanded more testing. And that, in turn, showed that we had more cases. And then when we saw those increased cases, we panicked again and asked for more testing, then track and trace. And this cycle became like a lemming rush off a cliff. It was a lemming cycle that fed itself. It was a downward spiral. That's why I called it continuous impairment in that little satirical comment. Yeah.
Yeah, and so ethical skeptics with us, and that dynamic, ethical, that is what I think empowered the lockdown to persist, wasn't it? Because I heard cases, and look, compared to you, I'm a monkey. I mean, I can synthesize data and read it, and I've spent some time in high tech, but not naval intelligence. I'm not a systems thinker. But I could look at some things and say, wait a minute, cases doesn't mean anything. Well, cases, that doesn't mean anything. If I get a case, and I'm very healthy at 50, that doesn't matter. Statistically, I'm not going to die from this. And it doesn't matter unless you're in these age groups we're talking about. So I got very frustrated with the predominant media coverage saying cases, cases, cases. And I wanted to say, but with who? Wait. How are the cases resolving? Are any of these cases where people had had T-cell immunity? And now we know that there's T-cell immunity, et cetera. Do you think that that cycle of cases, cases, more testing? Wait, there's more cases. We need more testing. Do you think that is what allowed the lockdown to persist as long as it did?
I think so. I think there were probably two species of mistake. Number one, we really didn't know what we should have known about coronaviruses going into this. And you could say, well, okay, we didn't have a great precedent set. You know, the last comparable coronavirus was in 2003, SARS-CoV-1. There's some explanation there, but we really didn't have a grasp of the latitudinal effect, that there would be a latitude surge at the end of this under a Hope Simpson effect. We really didn't look at this from the perspective of Farr's law, that this was going to be not a bell curve, but a somewhat lopsided bell curve, a quick increase and then a quick drop off. For some reason, we forgot all that epidemiological expertise and decided that this virus early on was some magical monster that was going to destroy us. And that was the first critique I had. We overreacted somewhat in the early stages of this as a result of that type of thinking. But then when we began to learn what was happening, when we saw the lemming cycle of panic and the feedback cycle of how testing was driving panic, we didn't take that lesson and then turn it into smarter actions. We continued, we doubled down on the lockdown. And the net result of those two species of error, the early misinterpretation of what this was and then the misinterpretation of the case increases, we used that to conduct a bad panic reaction, which is now bearing the potential to harm people greater than COVID itself did.
And I want to get to that because this is a phenomenally important piece of data and work that you've done. And Ethical Skeptic is with us on Twitter. He is at Ethical Skeptic, ethicalskeptic.com. I've been talking about this for some time because there's been physicians, Ethical. There's been, you know, some 600 physicians called the lockdown a mass casualty event. I've been, you know, talking with people in the adolescent mental health care world saying, hey, we're seeing an increase in suicides. And now I see, I had to talk on my show this morning about the fact that there are record high levels of male suicides in ages that generally don't lend themselves to these big spikes. You did an analysis, and I so admire that you source your data. I've observed you talking with other data analysts about your data and their data. It's like a casual sort of peer review, which I think is fascinating. And I think that this is also the story of reporting on the COVID. You've looked at deaths of misery and lack of access to healthcare and compared this to death from COVID-19. And you came up with some numbers I want everybody to understand. You said both are tragic, but one was manslaughter on top of tragic. Unreported COVID deaths grew to a 3.2-week backlog, 9 weeks of legacy death reporting. Break that down for us. And that's everything I sense, Ethical. But let's break down the numbers so people understand it.
Yes, a good portion of this comes from the MMWR database at the National Center for Health Statistics, NCHS, so and the CDC itself, but they're somewhat linked at the hip there. But what I'm estimating is that we've had about 200, as of August 15th, we've had about 245,000 excess deaths. Not all those are COVID deaths. The majority are COVID deaths. However, 57,600 of those deaths are deaths from the actual panic and lockdown itself. I hate to use the word lockdown because it implies that we're equivalent to every other country that locked down. That's not the case. But let's use the term lockdown here. We had really two types. Deaths that have ended so far, they were cardiac and diabetes deaths where individuals could not get access to acute care services, Alzheimer's deaths, which continue to be above the five-year average because of lack of access or abandonment, those types of issues, stroke access, lack of access to acute services, strokes increased, flu and pneumonia deaths increased. All that, for the most part, has ended since people are able to get back quickly to their critical health care resources. However, there are categories of fatalities in the U.S. that are still growing. Cancer, our most recent MMWR database review showed that what are called malignant myoplasms are growing at a significant rate now. These are people who couldn't get in to get cancer diagnoses. And this is a large number of people. This falls under a thing called the law of large numbers. COVID is an effect that happens to a small population, even though it sounds large to us. But cancer is an effect that happens to a very large population. So a very minor change in the landscape of cancer can result in a very large set of deaths at a later time. And indeed, that's what we're seeing occurring here, is that malignant myoplasm deaths are on the increase. In fact, it's increasing as of August 15th faster than I've even projected in this number that I just read you, the 57,600 COVID deaths. In addition to that, a more darkened or dismal side of this increase of deaths is what I call suicide addiction, abandonment, and abuse. These are deaths of despair. These are deaths for people who are at risk under substance abuse or under depression or types of mental illness, or people that have lost their livelihood. And that's what really concerns me, the number of businesses that are operating below their break-even level and are having to shut down, reduce operations, lay people off. Really, one-third of the people I know right now who were formerly employed are now unemployed because of COVID. And they won't lose their house during the COVID window. They're going to lose their homes 2 and 3 months from now. Those are the people I'm concerned about. That group of people falls under the law of large numbers. There are going to be dramatically more deaths that arise over the next 3 to 4 years from this SAANA, suicide, addiction, abandonment, and abuse, than all of the COVID deaths. But there's a second aspect to it, and you mentioned it. The people who die in these death categories are on average age 40, 50, 45, 36, 22. They have a greater number of life years remaining to their livelihood. Comparatively, the preponderance of COVID deaths, on average, I'm estimating, have about 5 to 6 years remaining life. And that's tragic as well, certainly. But if we multiply the number of people who've passed on under the COVID response versus those who passed on from COVID, by the years they had remaining in life, the stark reality is that the COVID reaction response has caused much more misery and death than has COVID, the virus itself.
Then there was this week this happened on social media, but it's not necessarily a new number. The CDC updated that their numbers to show that 6% of people died just from COVID-19. That was what killed them. There were no other factors to that. And that left 94% of people who died with COVID. You did an analysis, as I understand it, of the big 14 comorbidities. You drew this from databases. Let's talk about this, because the 6% is big news. And I've seen media people say, oh, this is conservatives trying to pretend that the virus isn't taking lives. And no, that's not at all what we're saying. Is what I'm saying is, no, I've seen a predominant media that has refused to say what you said, ethical, which is for people of advanced age, you should be very mindful and maybe even very careful around this virus. Those of us that are younger, we're far more likely to die of the flu. So you did
That's
this
correct.
Analysis of the 14 comorbidities, then you broke this out into the COVID deaths died because we panicked and would have died later. So let's talk about that as we wrap up.
Sure. This comes from the National Center on Health Statistics, the MMWR database that I previously mentioned. They maintain deaths by state, by week, by 14 major categories. So I scraped that data from their website and put that into a pivot structure, a pivot table, and analyzed it and deduced. And that means to simply eliminate or falsify until you get the one answer which remains, somewhat akin to the quip attributed to Arthur Conan Doyle and Sherlock Holmes. But deduction is that process which is definitive if you're able to eliminate every other possibility. You're left with the remaining possibility, especially with regard to math, because math is a closed set, you do end up with the remaining answer. And this is what I found, is that though it's not 6%. The 6% is somewhat a red herring, a distraction. They're shooting down the 6% as a conspiracy theory, when the number is wrong, but the principle is still correct. And we've got to see through that smokescreen. Those who passed on out of the MMWR database, the NCHS database, those who passed on from COVID alone are 19% of the excess deaths that we've experienced since March 28th this year. 19% are just COVID. You look on the death certificate and the U.701 categorization, primary cause of death is COVID, and there's nothing in the follow-on columns. That's 19%. Now, there's a thing called underlying conditions. Most people have underlying conditions. So if you're going to die, you're probably going to have a primary cause of death and underlying conditions. So this should be common. 27% of the total excess fatalities that the CDC has reported in their database are a primary cause of death by COVID, but also had underlying conditions. So most commonly, the average age of this death category is going to be 83, 86. Now, that's a guess on my part looking at the curves, but it's going to be pretty close. So that's underlying conditions. Then there's a next category where COVID is secondary or tertiary on the death certificate. And that's a different condition there. 23% of all the excess deaths were a situation where the individual died of a primary cause, but COVID was secondary. The danger we have here is a thing called a nosocomial death. In other words, you're coming to the hospital because you had a heart attack. You're at risk of dying from that heart attack. And then you contract COVID because you're in the RNA footprint of COVID at the hospital during that window of you know, the high preponderance of the virus being around. That's the group of deaths that concerns me the most, where COVID is secondary or tertiary. That's 23%. We do have a category of excess deaths which are unreported or not yet known, and I want to keep that for conservancy isolated out unto itself. That's 11%. We're still tapping into that with daily state reports, or what I call legacy death laundering, if you will. When you report a death as a state 6 weeks late, you're instilling panic in the population. You need to be clear and transparent on that data. That's still about 11% of total deaths. But the final important category are those deaths that originated from the panic response itself. That's 20% right now of all excess deaths that we've experienced this year actually were generated by our miscall politically and our bad actions in terms of social response to the COVID virus.
We've gone a little long. I want to ask if you can stick around with us, ethical skeptic.
Absolutely.
I want to ask you to do some analysis that's not numerical. This is going to take some supposition. Ethical skeptics with us on the Todd Herman Show on AM 770 KTTH. I want to get one bit of analysis from you that's not numerical. And this is where I have a real challenge, ethical skeptic, is we talked about the deaths from panic. We talked about the overreaction. I have a real hard time when I know that Tony Fauci's team had two people on his team who wrote a paper saying lockdowns don't work. Do not lock down in the case of a respiratory SARS type respiratory virus. It's counterproductive. That was a published work that I have to believe the CDC was aware of. Their doctors helped write it. We had the World Health Organization who had that point of view. They had points of view that contact tracing, after there's this, you know, in an urban area, you get past 50 people, contact tracing is a useless exercise. Dr. Scott Atlas has said the same thing and said that on my program in March. I see suddenly that they are, their studies, their data, their, you know, controlled randomized trials, I think 12 to 15 of them have said masks do not prohibit the flow or the transmission of SARS type respiratory viruses, but they're demanding that people wear masks. It's almost like all the learning, all the knowledge from the Spanish flu that, you know, the face coverings didn't work. They were universally held, universally. You could be shot, put in jail if you didn't wear them. It's almost like when this virus landed, the body of knowledge, the amassed learnings was just erased. And this takes some supposition on your part unless you have some data on this. But I look at this and I am left wondering, how in the world did they just forget everything or just ignore what they knew?
Well, I think a lot of it was intimidation from the data coming out of China and the World Health Organization early on. I mean, I was fully on board with that. I'm still on board that this is an exceptionally dangerous virus. That's clear in the data. But what we've done may become more dangerous than the virus itself. That's my central thesis right now. But early on, the intimidation factor, both from the virus and the news coming out of the WHO and China, I think it put us in a little bit of a social fight or flight syndrome, where we dropped our knowledge about latitudinal effects. We dropped our knowledge that coronaviruses are sharply seasonal, and there are scientific studies which prove that out. We dropped our knowledge about Farr's Law. We lost our resident knowledge. We lost our mind over the panic ensuing around this virus. And early on, I think the thirst for federal emergency money played a little bit into that, but I'm not sure that was an incorrect thing to do. We did need to allocate federal emergency funds to get testing rolled out and respond to the virus. But I think that it became an opportunity for political extremists to then exploit the condition. And in order to exploit the condition and harm their political enemies, those who operate medium to small businesses, they had to somewhat continue this forgetting of Farr's Law, to continue this forgetting of Hope Simpson, to continue this forgetting of key epidemiological truths and to squelch those things so that we could continue to harm political opponents. And this is what I call a human rights crime, because you do not spread misinformation to a population under duress in order to remove their sovereignty or the government's reporting to them. In other words, our government reports to our citizen base. You don't do that. And in doing 16 or 18 national strategies, it becomes clear to me that there are certain ethical actions that you do to favor and benefit the population of a nation. There are certain unethical actions you can do, which junta's do and warlords do. We did those things here. We fed misinformation to of people at risk. And that is one of the deepest, one of the darkest human rights crimes that can be committed. It doesn't mean the virus is not deadly, but what we did in the reaction became an artifice of political extremists, and those political extremists need to be held accountable. Their universities need to be held accountable. The foundations which fund those universities with offshore trading accounts, those need to be held accountable. And we need class action and oppression, harking back to the Monsanto precedent here of oppression. We need those lawsuits filed, because significant damage has been done and it's going to manifest over the next 3-4 years.
That's just beautifully said. It's frightening. And this has been the sense that one of the things I know, ethical skeptic, is I know politics. I know communication. I know selling and marketing and positioning and developing a market and creating a market and using wedge issues. And when I watched the predominant media go from 3 million will die, I was like you. I was telling my wife, we don't have any immune system. We have no immunity to this. This is nuts. I mean, yeah, we're going to lock down. We're going to, be careful. Very quickly, when I saw a picking of winners and losers that, okay, so a Planned Parenthood clinic, that's fine. But a dentist's office, that's not fine. I said, no, none of this is science. That was what got my suspicions up. But when I watched the major media go from deaths, they took a break during the riots and then started to scream about cases without context. That's where my antenna went up, because you've said this is a very dangerous virus. It's uniquely dangerous. And then you say ellipses for this population. And I've seen multiple attempts made by the government to say that the children are going to die from this. They're still doing this. In the state of Washington, they're still merchandising the idea that COVID stalks minority kids. They're still merchandising. That's a quote, stalks them. So that's where I got frustrated. So it's interesting to hear someone with a far different skill set, far smarter than me in systems thinking, come to that same conclusion. So I want to thank you for joining us on the Todd Herman Show. It's just a real honor to have you on. And I want you to know that you and Justin Hart and Kyle Lamb and you guys are the story on this. And I think that your analysis on this has been so key, so helpful. I just think it's heroic. And I appreciate you coming on the Todd Herman Show. I think it's your first radio interview, isn't it?
It is on this, and as ethical skeptic, I think I've had a couple of podcasts, but really first significant radio interview. Absolutely.
All right. Well, then I am very proud of that. Ethical skeptic, thanks for joining us on the Todd Herman Show. Keep up the great work. We need you.
Thank you, Todd. Appreciate it.